I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Last year, Kiran Desai won the Man Booker Prize for Fiction for her critically acclaimed novel, The Inheritance of Loss. She joins me this morning from here in Vancouver to discuss the book and her career. Just published in paperback, The Inheritance of Loss is available from Penguin and retails for $18. Her previous book was Hullabaloo in the Guava Orchard. I am pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Kiran Desai. Good morning, Ms. Desai.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The book has many themes, but the three major themes that people have said of your book deal with migration, living in two different worlds, and trying to reconcile the past and the present. Would you agree that those are the major themes of the book?
Migration, living. You know, I never think of my work in these terms. I think themes are what critics go in and uncover, and then they say there's two, or there's one, or there's five. You know, that's just not the way I think of it at all. When I think of my book, it still is, just an emotional landscape to me. A certain sort of a place where all my thoughts went. And you know what it's like when you write a book, every single thing you think of, everything you see, everything goes to the same place. Yes, thoughts about migration, thoughts about my family history, thoughts about, one person feeling ashamed all alone in a room, you know, all these many things.
When you go into writing a book, I guess if you don't think about the themes in particular, what do you go into the book or go into the story thinking of? Like what's the goal, I suppose?
You're really getting to the heart of my embarrassment. When I'm working, and I was working on this book, it's very different from my first book. I had no plot, no plan, and I was working in what you could call a really mystical fashion. You know, I was not noticing time passing by, and 8 years passed by, so a significant amount of time, and I wrote everything that came into my mind. I mean, one day it might just have been the look of the landscape, you know, or something very small. The thought of a frog in a water tank high up above the bamboo in an old house in the mountains. Just treating it like a line of poetry, maybe. And one thought leading to the next, one idea leading to the next, one character to the next, across national boundaries, and going back and forth in time. And I wasn't thinking of it as a novel. I was forcing the habit of writing, I suppose. So writing was my life entirely. My writing did not exist separately. It was all the same thing, which is quite unhealthy, but really wonderful, I think, for a writer. And the novel was almost beside the point. I lifted it out of about 1,500 pages, I think about 6 years or 6 or 7 years into the book.
And when you talk about 6 to 7 years, are you writing the whole time, or do you take breaks? Do you do other projects?
No, I write the whole time, every single day, and pretty much all day. I would work in the morning, and, you know, yes, the afternoon is always a bit of a dead time for me, but then in the evening again, I work really well, and in a completely opposite way from morning hours. Morning hours are very, much more clear, and I edit and think in a much more rational way. And in the evening, something else happens, and I find I write very differently. So both are important, but that means, of course, I have no life. My only hours of free time in the afternoon when everyone else is working or off somewhere. So that became very strange.
But did you work on other stories, or just this specific story during that time
just
period?
Just this one. And, of course, there were so many more meditations and thoughts about different things. It went back further in time. It continued up into the present. So, it covered more countries. So all of that really went. I distilled the story from all those pages, again, for the sake of trying to capture a certain emotional pattern and historical pattern, and to reach that feeling of that loneliness between places and between characters, and yet how we are still so closely linked to different sides of the world, and yet that sort of trying to reach a sort of meadow landscape, not a red, it wasn't a red-blooded story that I was telling.
Do you write on a computer or do you write longhand?
I write longhand, because I lose my self-consciousness more. Again, it helps me to reach that mystical space that I'm talking about. I've become, you know, as soon as if I write on a computer, I'm so conscious of it already looking like a line of print in a book that I find that instead of moving on, I just circle back and start polishing, and really can't get to that weird, eccentric, dark place that I'm always looking for. But it is another reason. I think I always just get seduced by the look of the manuscript.
Right.
The look of my handwriting, which I then exaggerate, so it looks crazier and crazier, so I can't even read it when I'm actually editing, when I'm editing myself. I find myself, you know, sometimes completely lost. So, yes.
How do you know when the story is done? I mean, you worked on it for 6 years, 7 years. You lifted it from, as you said, 1,500 pages of a manuscript that you'd written.
Yes.
How do you stop perfecting it, or do you?
I didn't know, and I think it really is the most difficult thing, maybe for any art form, you know, as a composer, as a painter. I always wonder how they manage to know when to stop. And I think, you know, it is a flawed book, and there are problems with it. I think there's a certain stage, though, when you realize that that rawness or even the mistakes will still make it a better book than if you start polishing and perfecting it. But rawness can really help, you know, I mean, it's, in a way, perhaps allows you to get to a more honest emotion than something that is so polished and so perfect that, you know, you can't get that sort of human response anymore, if I'm making sense. But also, I think I also felt that I was at a stage where as soon as I began to fix something and I began to polish something up and, you know, really address one problem, it created another. And there was a realization that somehow in all these years, the novel had become a certain thing, and even though it was flawed, it would have to remain that way because changing one thing would just create another flaw somewhere else.
I mentioned at the top migration as one of the themes. I just want to ask about your personal experience. You were born in India and you immigrated to the United States.
Yes.
Did your experience as an immigrant inform this book?
Oh, so much. So much. It really was true very much on my own history. We went to England for a year and then to the United States, and those are the three countries covered by the book, India, England, and the States. So it's very much, it was close to my own experience, yes.
Do you identify yourself as an American or an Indian or a Brit?
You know, neither. And the more, somewhat the older I get, and perhaps even especially after writing this book, it's more and more difficult for me to identify myself as Indian American or Indian. Because I suppose it immediately makes me very wary of, you know, this kind of nationalist rhetoric that we're seeing everywhere, and this ideas of the flag and belonging and fighting for a notion of what it means. And we're really, this is a time in the world where we're really fighting for the notion of what it means to be American or what it means to be Indian. You know, people are dying in this war. I think in a country like the States, although I tried to draw a parallel with immigration in India as well, because of course it isn't merely a Western issue. Every country deals with this question of immigration and how to ask loyalty, demand loyalty of immigrants. Is it fair? Is it not fair? I don't know. But that vocabulary I greeted with is extremely simple, that vocabulary of belonging in the United States. And just at the moment when your own sense of yourself and your own identity is becoming much more complicated, and you're realizing how wobbly it all is anyway, how many times you can reinvent yourself, how much hypocrisy there is in this process, and how much cruelty there is. So for me, I really try to avoid those labels.
Do you struggle yourself to reconcile your past, wherever your past lies, and your present?
I do, because I think writing made me very aware of this difficulty. I probably would have felt it anyway, but as a writer I feel it acutely when I was writing this book, and even as I'm thinking of another book, I always, as a writer you have to have that sort of emotional depth, that historical depth that informs your work, and that I don't have in the United States. I don't have grandparents who lived in the States. My history doesn't go that deep, and therefore emotionally I can't access it as deeply. But that means, of course, it is a very divided life. I have to return to India for that depth and to sort of complete all my arguments. So it is a bit of a it always involves a constant feeling of a journey.
Your mother, Anita Desai, she's a novelist.
Yes.
When did you take up writing, and when did you start thinking of yourself as a writer?
I was about 20, and I had been studying science and writing. My great glory as a science student was a paper called "Cannibalism in the Common House Cricket: A Cheetah Domesticus," and I was sure that was how my career was going to progress. Great. And then I took a writing class. I'd always been a big reader, and I read very, very passionately all my life, ever since I was a child, and just thought, oh, it'll be easy, science, all these difficult classes, chemistry, biology, I'll take this little writing class, and it'll be fun. And as soon as I wrote my first short stories, which were called Hair Oil, and then there was The Toilet and the Government Official, which was deeply influenced by Chekhov, I realized I was so happy, so extremely happy that I switched immediately from studying science, and also realized that the science was actually really just fiction. It was really suspect, and that cannibalism, the house cricket, was really, I think, again, it was much more to do with fiction than science. Why men eat women, why women eat men, jealousy, conflict, sad love affairs.
Right.
lack of dinner. So at that point I switched and began to, stop molesting. I stopped molesting little crickets.
From the science background, where obviously research is part of the process in that background. Mm. Do you do a lot of research when you write novels?
A little bit. This book was close to, of course it's all fiction, but it was close to my experience. I know that part of India. It drew on people I met in New York, but a little bit. Certainly I read a lot of memoirs of people who had been in the Indian civil service. So for certain things I do.
And do you travel to certain places to get that look of the Himalayas or?
Yes, I remembered it from my childhood, but I wanted to make sure that the memory was accurate and that my argument would still work, that it would still make sense to link all these different places together. And also to talking of immigration, if it would really work, talking of it in this sort of shadow class of New York illegal immigrants, and then talking of immigration and that very complicated border in India, border that had shifted back and forth for as long as anyone can remember, the northeastern border. And so I did return, and I wrote all those bits set in the Himalayas in this town during the rainy season, and I just stayed and worked in a very isolated way, really learning, how lonely and how beautiful it is to be a writer.
One reviewer mentioned that despite being set in the 1980s, your book seemed to be the best kind of post-9/11 novel. Why do you think that critic said that about your book, and do you think that it is a post-9/11 book?
He was really flattering me. I was writing this book, a long time before 9/11, and I continued writing it many years after 9/11, while also being, also thinking, oh, the world is changing so fast, and I'm, still writing a book that seems, in a way, set in the past. But, I was reading an interview that Michael Ondaatje recently gave, and he said that it seems as if every book really is more about the present times, even if it is set in the past, because you're always addressing current concerns. And, of course, I was reading and constantly involved in the news and thinking about all these matters of immigration and of this anger, really being very conscious of this enormous anger between first world and the developing world, of course it came bursting out at 9/11, but it had been building a long, long time. And I think the roots of it go back so, not into the recent past, but well into the past. So certainly that anger was something, that shame and that anger and the fight to maintain your dignity and humanity in a world of such enormous power differences, that is very much what I was trying to write about. 9/11, I think, was a manifestation of that, a completely surreal, bizarre manifestation of that, that happens to happen.
Your book won many prizes, and I guess the chief among them is the Booker Prize. This week they announced Anne Enright has won the Booker for The Gathering. What's it like to win the Booker Prize, and what do you think she's going through?
It's certainly surreal, and you're always so conscious, I think, when you're in this process of being in the shortlist, longlist, shortlist, and sitting in that room waiting for the prize to be announced. I think you're really aware of how precarious it all is and how much compromise is involved and how lucky you are, that your book was sent up by the publishers, that it happened to appeal to the taste of a few people. So you realize how precarious it is, and also you realize that prizes really are very childish, first, second, third, it seems like a return to childhood in a way, and winning it, I think, I felt certainly childish pleasure, which was very nice to feel as an adult, nice to feel like a child as an adult, but what becomes very frightening is that, of course, it has serious effect. It really does, and yet, I personally feel one should use that serious effect by being even more childlike, and, you're allowed to, I think winning a prize like this really means you can experiment more. You feel as if you can take more risks. At least that's the effect it's had on me. But watching Anne Enright win yesterday and seeing her on BBC, my first thought was, oh, thank goodness the beauty pageant has moved on, and I'm so relieved I don't have a book out next year.
Right.
And I'm not in that room. My life is going to go back to, peace and quiet.
What are you working on now, may I ask?
I don't know. I always have to be working to be able to uncover the story. I always have to be at my desk. So I can sense, just like with this last book, I can sense that there's something there. It almost feels like the white whale. That I can tell that there's something, I don't know whether it's malevolent or, it's going to be a good spirit, but I can see little signs of it, and I can sense the sort of emotional landscape of it, but it's still a mystery to me. And in fact, I was just still laughing to myself yesterday, saying, oh, I could even write a book about this non-book. The non-book is such a presence in my life. It's following me everywhere, this phantom book. I'm completely obsessed by it. I think about it all day, all the time. So, that would make a lovely book in itself.
Is there a lot of pressure from publishers and so on to come out with another book?
No, I don't feel it at all. Writers are always telling me, I have a deadline coming up, and I have to finish, and my agent is calling me, and my publishers are calling me. And I always suspect them of lying, because I really feel as if it's such a busy world. There's talent everywhere bursting out. I don't actually find that they do care, at least it's not been my experience. I think as a writer, you're the only one who really cares. And I was, you know, about 5 years late with my deadline the last time around. 5 or 6 years, and nobody said a word to me.
Really?
Yes. So I'm not worried about that.
You mentioned earlier that you grew up a passionate reader. Mm-hmm. As a writer, how important is it to read?
Tremendously important. I think both for the books that influence you directly and for, you know, being tantalized by the books that that you can never imitate. You know, a lot of what I read is just, I read for what I'll never be able to do. And it, you know, it makes me sort of insanely jealous and happy at the same time, both combined. And yeah, I'll be reading Calvino or Nabokov, or I'm reading a lot of Japanese author Tanizaki's work I love, and I'll read a line, I'll get up, I'll sit down, I'll read more, get up. It's almost unbearable to read a work that you love so much. Then I run to my own desk and try and work, then I read some more of their work. So I think it's tremendously important. It's a constant somehow relationship between what I'm reading or what I have read and my own work.
To close, you mentioned about finding it unbearable to read other people's books because they're just so good.
Unbearable and wonderful. I mean, I can't stay away either.
Right. How does it feel for you when people are reading your books in the same way?
I'm flattered. Immediately, I get extremely pleased if someone says that. When I think of what the heart of my life is or my emotional experience in the world is, that's where it's at, you know. It's reading the new Michael Ondaatje book and thinking yet again, a superb writer.
Kieran, it's been a pleasure to have you on and a pleasure to talk to you today, and I do thank you for appearing with us, and congratulations again on this great book and all the prizes. It's well deserved, certainly.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The book is called The Inheritance of Loss. It's published by Penguin. It's out now in paperback, $18. I'm Joseph Planta.